from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, do you have a difficult coworker or hard-to-please boss? Someone who fails to complete their work or takes credit for yours? Someone who interrupts you during meetings or who always finds fault with you? We'll talk with workplace experts to get their advice on how to approach those difficult workplace challenges and how best to have face-to-face conversations with difficult coworkers. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Do you put up with or feel you must endure dysfunctional colleagues or dysfunctional coworkers, annoying fellow employees who make you want to emit some form of primal screaming? Or perhaps are you one of those types yourself without knowing or acknowledging that you are? And what about relations with higher-ups, the boss or bosses or the brass? We focus our attention in this Forum Hour on the workplace and what can be done about dispiriting, disheartening, or just plain dysfunctional and annoying workplace interactions. And we have a panel. Mitchell Marks is here with us in studio. He's a professor in the College of Business at San Francisco State, author of Charging Back Up the Hill, Workplace Recovery After Mergers, Acquisitions, and Downsizings. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be here. It is still morning.
Good to be here. Not on the East Coast, but here. And thank you for being with us. Patrick Lencioni is joining us. He's founder of The Table Group, author of 10 best-selling business books, including The Advantage and The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. Welcome, Patrick Lencioni.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Sharon Salzberg, who's with us this morning also by phone. She's author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. Welcome, Sharon Salzberg.
Thanks so much.
Glad to have all of you aboard. And let me begin, Mitchell Marks, with you. I know you've done some research in Silicon Valley. I'm not going to get into the weeds with you. But the idea of people, they're really having blind spots, not understanding that they're difficult with their coworkers or that they present problems. And the fact of the matter is that many of those people who are working with fellow employees don't understand the difficulties in the other employees. So we've got blind spots on both sides, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So let's talk about how you see a blind spot in yourself or how you see a bring recognition to someone who has a blind spot about themselves.
Well, the first thing I would suggest to someone who has a difficult coworker or has a difficult boss is don't think about them, think about you. That might sound counterintuitive, but the reality is you have to think about what happens if I go to the mat with this person here. And so you have to think about the fact that no one else in the organization may not be seeing that happening, what you're experiencing, which would be your own personal blind spot. But the bigger issue, I think, is what psychologists call attribution theory. When you succeed in your career, in your business, you say, ah, I'm good. I know my stuff. I'm a good business person. When you have difficulties and when you fail, you blame it on the situation. So it's not me. It's not nothing I'm doing. It was the politics in the company, or it was the economy at the time.
Or it was other people.
Or it's other people. Yeah. And so to get to your question, if I'm encountering a difficult person, whether they're a coworker or a boss, the fact is you should assume that they don't see it, that they don't know it, that they've never gotten feedback. And you should also assume that the higher they move in the hierarchy of the organization or the more successful they are, the more they've gotten positive confirmation of what they're doing is what's right. That doesn't mean that your situation and your discomfort is wrong or inappropriate. It may be very valid. But the fact is, before you start pointing fingers and blaming others, you've got to think about they may not know, or the organization may not have any awareness also. So you may be the messenger who brings this up. And
they sometimes shoot the messenger, as you know.
Often. Yes.
So, I mean, what you need, perhaps, and I think you do suggest this in your work, is some kind of corroboration. I mean, you talk to other employees. If you have a difficult employee, are they having similar problems? Maybe even talk to HR without sounding like you're a squealer along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really depends on the situation in your organization. If you work for a large corporation, it's different than if you work for a small startup. If you work for a large corporation, the first question I would ask you is, how's the HR function in your organization? look, let's be realistic here. There's HR functions in companies that are world class, and there's HR functions that are afterthoughts. If you have an afterthought kind of HR function, ignore them and go to your coworkers. If you have an HR function that's world class, that is really highly regarded in the organization, they can probably help you. If you work for a smaller organization where you're rubbing elbows with everybody every day at the workplace, then you're not going to want to go to the administration. First of all, there probably is no HR person if it's a smaller organization. It's probably the family member of the CEO or the entrepreneur. You know, they just think of HR last, unfortunately. But in that case, that might be a situation where you want to go directly to the person who you're having issues with.
Well, that was the next thing I was going to ask. I mean, how advisable is it? I suppose, you know, every situation is different, has to be measured, but to appropriate some kind of conversation with someone who is an annoyance or an impediment or just difficult coworker, do it diplomatically, do it respectfully, but let's be direct.
Well, be direct, but make it about you, not them. In other words, you don't want to go and say, hey, you're difficult. That's the worst thing you can do. What you want to say is, I'm having some difficulty with you. It sounds simple, but it just changes the whole tone of the conversation. And again, check it out first. What you have to think about is your personal situation. If you've been trying to get this job for months and you finally landed it, and there aren't many other jobs in that particular field, then you should behave differently than if you're a salesperson and people are dying to get a new salesperson, you know, or you're some kind of IT person where there's lots of jobs out there.
You should also behave differently if you're dealing with someone directly who happens to be a big rainmaker or producing within the company, yeah?
Well,
tread carefully.
You have to think about it. Look, if you cause disruption in the revenue stream, who are they going to get rid of, you or the rainmaker? That's a pretty obvious thing. That, again, it's not to discredit what you're going through or the reality of what you're experiencing, but you really do have to think about, what does it mean to me in the worst case scenario that perhaps I might be shot because I'm the messenger.
Talking to Professor Mitchell Marks, who is professor in the College of Business at San Francisco State University and an organizational psychologist. And what about if it's the boss that's annoying you or getting on your nerves or presenting difficulties with your peace and quiet in the workplace?
Well, first, do talk to others. Talk to other coworkers. You know, talk to other people who are reporting to that person. See if your experience is distinct or if it's commonplace. If there's something distinct going on, I would invite the boss out for a beverage before or after work. You know, get a coffee before work or go to happy hour after work if you're so inclined. I think the thing to do is try and approach this, not that I want to blame you, my boss, for being problematic, but hey, boss, I'm feeling a little uptight about this situation. How can we work this out? What can I do to help you succeed? That would be one of my first questions. Boss, I know you're under a lot of pressure. I know we got this big project that came on. You've been really hard on me in it. I just want to succeed. So again, you're depersonalizing it. It's not about you, boss, you're bad.
Put it on me.
It's about, yeah.
Yeah, but in so many instances, you may be not even culpable in the slightest way. You may be dealing with someone who is just dysfunctional and exceedingly difficult.
And that's where it goes back to your situation. If it's hellish, get out. Don't waste your time. If it's hellish and you think you can find another position, then don't waste your life doing this. On the other hand, if you just got the dream job and if you see a future for you in the organization, tread very carefully.
Well, Sharon Salzberg, let's go to you. And Cheryl Salzberg is author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations, excuse me, for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. It's very difficult to find happiness at work for many people. It's often undermined because it's a toxic workplace or it's a toxic culture or because they're dealing with difficult people. So what if you have somebody working with you or above you that you simply don't like or, you know, that is exceedingly difficult to work with, Sharon Salzberg?
Well, it certainly happens, and in fact, when people heard my book title, they would often laugh and say things like, well, you know, we don't call it play. If it was supposed to be happy, you would call it play. You wouldn't call it work. But they say that the largest predictor of happiness at work is a sense of meaning, and sometimes we find the meaning in the job description. Sometimes we have to infuse it, and it's made much more difficult, of course, with difficult coworkers, colleagues, clients, supervisors, but it still may be possible, and I would certainly support everything that was just said, and I would talk about specificity. You know, if you're looking for feedback from, say, a supervisor, ask for specificity instead of just getting these messages like you're a jerk or you're lazy or whatever, and always use I language. It sounds a little formulaic, but it actually is. It's much more powerful to describe your experience, to seek understanding. And I would also say, almost from the meditative point of view, that it's always good to look at your own intention before a conversation or a confrontation or a meeting, because what do you really want to see come out of this experience? Do you want to find a resolution? Do you want to hurt the other person? Do you want to help the other person? And then you know what's really guiding you.
Sometimes you don't know and you can't determine that. I mean, if you're unconscious, it may be very deeply involved. But you're right. You use the word meditation. You write a lot about almost what sounds like a Buddhistic approach to the workplace. That is compassion and mindfulness and concentration, these kinds of virtues. And indeed, they can be applied and ought to be applied perhaps in life and all. But in the workplace, sometimes it can be just so exasperating. You think, how can I concentrate? I can't concentrate. I can't be compassionate. This person's driving me nuts.
Well, it is tough, and you're right. Of course, you know, we can be completely unconscious, but that's the point, is that we can actually train our capacity to be aware so that we can be in touch with the things that may be driving us that we don't normally see. And we say, in terms of trying to be mindful or compassionate at work, the goal is actually something like short moments many times. Don't try to think about having a perfect day or being perfectly enlightened at work all the time, but just take a moment to break the crazy momentum that may be surrounding you and someone else's kind of nastiness or whatever their attitude is, and come back to yourself, come back to the moment, and then you will remember your values and your priorities. It doesn't take a lot. It takes a lot to remember to do it.
Well, you even have in your book 8 pillars of happiness in the workplace, and those pillars, of course, again, remind me of Buddhistic thinking. Let me just relate them to listeners. Balance, concentration, compassion, resilience, communication and connection, integrity, meaning, open awareness. What's right at the top of those? Is there one that's at the top?
I think balance, because that's born of mindfulness, and the more we can pay attention. Mindfulness really means having a quality of attention that's not so biased, so that we have more of an open mind. It's like not going into that meeting with such a rigid, tight agenda that we can't listen or we can't see options, we can't learn or be creative. So it's a quality of awareness that can be open, and if we do that, then the rest will follow.
There's a lot of quality of awareness with the threat of being fired, though. I mean, particularly if
there's
you're going after
one.
The boss, right?
Yeah. No, there's a big one, and you know, you need skillful communication. And again, you know, you have to look at what your options are realistically. You know, can you leave? You know, is there a multitude of opportunity awaiting you? Or are you in some way for now kind of stuck? And if you're stuck, how can you make this the best situation possible?
Sharon Salzberg with us, author of Real Happiness at Work, Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. I just wonder if I could ask you about one other thing in light of what you point out in your book, which is that Americans actually put more hours at work or in work than anyone else throughout the whole world. And given that, I mean, I don't know about North Korea, for example, and places like that, but from what we know in terms of regular metrics, but you talk about the importance of having a clarity of the core of your sense of self with the role that you play at work. That's critical for what you call peace of mind. I mean, getting those two again in balance.
Well, you know, I often talk about, I am a meditation teacher, and I came back from India in 1974 as a teacher, and I would be at a party or some social situation, and somebody would say to me, "What do you do?" And I'd say, "I teach meditation." And in those days, they would often kind of sidle away, like, "Oh, that's weird." You know, and now there's a very different response. But the one key point is that question, you know, don't we ask one another, "What do you do? What do you do? What do you do?" We don't say, like, "What was your surprising experience today?" Or, you know, "What makes you happy?" Or, "What interests you?" It's very much consumed with "What do you do?" And we can break out of that.
Well, let me bring Patrick Lencioni into this. He's the founder of The Table Group, author of 10 best-selling business books, including The Advantage and The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. I want to talk about dysfunction with you, Patrick, but let's also talk about the importance of being open and being vulnerable and just expressing what's on your mind. There are ways to do it. You agree with essentially the wisdom of what's said, that often it's good to begin with you rather than the other person?
Yes, and when we begin with us, we need to be vulnerable, which is one of the most countercultural and counterintuitive ways to approach things. But as it turns out, people that can be vulnerable, which is radically humble, if you will, they put themselves out there first. And as both of the guests, Mitchell and Sharon, have said, you know, you start by not focusing on them, but focusing on yourself, and you do that with them too, and you let them know. I think one of the best things you can do, and when you talk to somebody about a problem you're having with them, is open up about a problem you have about yourself, and let them know that you're not perfect, and let them know that you recognize that there's probably issues that you have that you're working on as well. And when you do that, you usually get people to become less defensive, and you're genuinely saying, I don't think I'm more important than you, and I don't think I'm perfect. And that's when people become open to hearing what you have to say. Now, again, vulnerability is not something we come out of the womb doing, but people that can become vulnerable, they build trust, and that's the key to this. When you're vulnerable with other people, they trust you.
You have to train to be vulnerable, actually.
Yeah, you have to practice it. Almost like being an
Olympic athlete or something along those lines. But I'm looking actually at a piece you wrote where you say the only way for leaders to address dysfunctional situations effectively is to openly admit they feel frustrated, disappointed, or overburdened or underappreciated. That sounds good, but they also have to express their discontent and their, frankly, sometimes exasperation and frustration, don't they?
Yeah, and that gets back to the I statement that somebody said before. You're not saying, you guys are making me feel discontented or you guys are doing this wrong. It's you approach them and you say, I'm weak. I'm hurting here. And you do that in all honesty. And usually what you do is you provoke people to help you work through it. If you do that in the wrong way, you're only going to make them defensive and accusational. So it becomes what I say is a radical humility.
Yeah, but there's also a piece you wrote called The Dilemma of the Difficult Employee, and you say what people rarely do is sit down and tell an employee in no uncertain terms that their attitude needs to change.
Well, this is the biggest thing. People come to me all the time and say, what should I do about this employee? They're not very good at this, or they annoy me, and they annoy others. And most times, they've told that employee that once at most. And they tell each other every day. They complain about that person, not directly to them, but
they're venting to other people, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they think they're doing, I find this, I do a lot of work in churches, and people think that they're supposed to be nice, and so they don't confront people. And all that does is brings about the most hurtful kind of behavior behind the scenes. Sitting down with a person, especially if you're a manager, sitting down with a person and reminding them, kindly, vulnerably, but directly, that these are the behaviors that are causing problems, and I really need you to change them, and I'll remind you every day if I have to. Most human beings, when they're regularly reminded, will do one of two things. They'll change their behavior because they don't like annoying people, or they'll leave, both of which are better than the alternative, which is they stay and they continue, and then you have to get HR and the legal department involved.
Yeah, then you have the possibility of a lawsuit and
morale
problems and all those things that crop up. So what's the best way to confront someone if they're not working as a team member or they're just simply being dysfunctional?
I think the first thing to do is to make yourself vulnerable and say, hey, listen, if you're a manager or, heck, even a coworker, you go to somebody and say, let me tell you about something that happened in my career, and somebody came to me and they really helped me by pointing this out, and I'm forever indebted to them for this. So they say, okay, so you're not perfect and you've struggled, and then you tell them, here's what I see, and I could be wrong, but I'm telling you this for your benefit. And again, as Sharon said, we have to purify our intentions. And when we go to them and we say, I'm telling this to you for your benefit, most people in that case are going to appreciate that. Those that don't, there gets to be a point when we realize there's some abnormal psychology going on here and they're just not open to it, they're invulnerable, and there are some people in life that are, then prudence comes into play.
Mitchell Marks, you want to add something?
Yeah, I would add two points to this very good advice. Number one is take the high road.
Yep.
Is remember that when you start raising up these issues, the spotlight becomes on you. And how you do it. So everything you've heard on this program in terms of making it about me, not about you, just make sure you're not attacking the person. Make sure you're definitely trying to show your style. You want, even if you don't quote unquote win after all this episode, people will say, you know, she really did it with class. She really did it with style. So that could actually be a win with you, even if you have this difficult
situation.
Because
being too vulnerable can be counterintuitively against being classy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but you got to take the heart. The other thing is, because you raised up, it might go to legal, it might to HR. Do take notes. Do write everything down. Do document all episodes. Hopefully, you won't need it. But down the road, if there was ever to get to a legal situation, your files look in order. Your notes look in order. It looks very impressive if it gets down to that.
Well, let me take this opportunity to invite those of you who are listening to join the conversation here. And certainly, some of you probably are seeking advice. You may have a problem that you are looking for a solution for, and we've got an excellent panel here, and you may want to shed some light just on what we're talking about, which is essentially how do you get people to perform better in the workplace, to work more as team members, to work more in concert with you, not be so annoying. I mean, in my research for this program, I can't tell you how many different types of people were outlined in articles in Forbes and the like of the sort of people that give you a difficult time at the workplace. Everything from, you know, the indolent, lazy type to the one who blames everyone else for their problems, to the sort of person who's simply narcissistic and self-promoting all the time, to the gossip. I mean, it just goes on and on. And I think many of you are probably looking for some answers, so this is the place, and you can call us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your contributions to the program with questions or comments. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, and let's start getting our calls on. Phil, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Listen, I'm seeking advice. I'm in a situation where I'm trying to give advice to my manager or my manager's manager, and I'm trying to prevent whether it's revenue protection or a supervisor that's treating their team badly and they're all going to quit, or if messaging I think sounds bad, or just plans of actions that I'm letting them know my thoughts, this is going to go south. And time again, they don't listen to me. They trust their experience more. But that's actually my position, what to do. Now, I've tried being self-effacing and say, help me know what you need when I tell you guys these things so you can hear the information. Or I say, am I not coming across clearly? But at the end of the day, they just trust their experience more than mine. And I can't, I don't know what to do in these situations anymore, because at the end of the day, people are looking to me to prevent some of these things, and I can't prevent them if my manager and up the chain aren't listening.
Phil, no, you're not getting through. That's
What I'm curious, Phil, why are people, you say people are looking to you. Who's looking to you? Is it different than the people who are not listening to you?
Well, he's middle management, I assume, right, Phil?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So can I go to you, Patrick Lencioni?
Yeah, I think this is interesting. In my career for years and years, I was the guy that people would shove into the CEO's office and say, you tell him, even when I didn't work for the CEO. And I always thought, well, this sounds a little risky, and I'd tell my staff, say a prayer, we're either going to get fired or promoted. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, we were rewarded because we went in and told the manager, told the CEO things, and we told them with the kind truth. So if you can approach people and tell them the kind truth, and it sounds like you're doing that, Phil. If you're doing
that, it sounds like he's hitting brick walls, though.
In which case, you thank God for that, and you say, now you have a decision to make. Do I accept the fact that I work with a brick ceiling above me, or do I leave? But at least you've done that, and you know it. So many people never go there, and they always wonder. But at some point, you can't bloody yourself by banging your head on that wall again and again. Now, you've asked people for better ways to do it. It sounds like you've been open-minded about the way you approach them. It might very well be that they're just not vulnerable enough to hear from you, in which case the serenity prayer comes into play.
Well, good luck to you, Phil, and thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your calls when we return. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about, well, dealing with difficult coworkers, but also, well, do you have a difficult coworker or a hard-to-please boss, someone who simply fails to complete their work or takes credit for yours or maybe someone who interrupts you during meetings or always seems to find fault with you. Workplace experts are with us to give advice on how to approach tricky office relationships. Mitchell Marks here in studio is professor of the College of Business at San Francisco State and author of Charging Back Up the Hill, Workplace Recovery After Mergers, Acquisitions, and Downsizing. Patrick Lencioni with us by phone is founder of The Table Group and author of a number of best-selling books, including The Advantage and The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And Sharon Salzberg, also with us, is the author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. And I had said in the previous segment, before we went to that break, that I'd done a good deal of research, and with thanks to people like Susie Welch and Peggy Drexler, there are so many different types of complaints about annoying people that you work with. You have no idea. They even have names for them: the narcissist, the malcontent, the passive aggressive, the suck up, the backstabber, the disruptor, workaholics, people who pass off a lot of work, or the people who always take the credit for the work, people who are shouting all the time in the tone of their voice, people who are simply not professional or too negative or waste time at meetings with all kinds of questions and ramblings, braggers, gossips, people who take long personal calls or treat the office like a food court. I mean, you know, it covers just an extraordinarily wide range of kind of complaints people have about those that they work with. And let me go back for the moment before we go to more calls here, Sharon Salzberg, if I could, to you, because you write in your book a lot about emotional intelligence. You know, sometimes it's just important maybe to take a deep breath or to count to 10 or maybe to scream into a drawer. But the kind of sense of being kind and diplomatic and respectful, maybe even shaming people on occasion, which is probably a good effective tool or as part of the toolkit, but also being emotionally aware of other people can sometimes just go so far. You know, you just have somebody who's disrupting the team and messing up.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think one needs good boundaries. You need clear communication, even if it's fierce and kind of intense. But, you know, our intention can be not to destroy the person, but to try to make things better. And I have an extremely annoying piece of advice, which is sometimes it's actually useful to see if you can find one good thing about that person, because by the time they are set rigidly in your mind as the narcissist and the this and the that and the that, then there's no possibility of seeing change. So I'm not talking about denying all the rest or trying to pretend it's not there, but see if we can get maybe a bigger picture of this person. And then also, I mean, the compassion doesn't mean that you don't take a stand and that you don't have a real determined effort to make things better, but it's almost like reminding yourself, I'm just encountering this person for these 20 minutes or even for these 8 hours. They live in there.
No, there's a real balance between being, let's say, humble and confrontative, or being vulnerable and being authoritative.
Oh, definitely, and we need to be strong. I think maybe that's one of the great cultural mistakes we make, is thinking compassion means being weak and meek and sweet.
Absolutely.
And mild.
Yeah, tough love is missing these days.
Yeah, very much so. And compassion can be the most powerful force, and it can manifest as something very tough, very fierce, very intense.
Tough love, Mitchell Marks. Tough like, maybe, too, huh?
Well, yeah, at the end of the day, it comes to what your aspirations are. You could have the worst boss in the world, but if you're making money and if you're bringing a new product to market, and if that's going to look good on your resume, you deal with it. You know, I mean, the fact is you've got to step back and look at the bigger picture. I've known a lot of successful people who have talked to me about their bosses who were the bosses from hell, but I learned from them. They helped me get things done. They helped me look good on my resume. And sometimes you just take it. Look, the fact is that most, as I said earlier today, most people who have made it up the hierarchy haven't gotten a lot of negative feedback. They made it up the hierarchy because they've gotten positive feedback. They've been told throughout their career, you're good. The way you do things is good. We like that. We reward that. Okay, so for you to show up and say you're doing something wrong is just not going to be recognized by them. You'll be out the door before you know it. So,
hey, Michael, there's two exercises we do with client groups that
Patrick
Lencioni,
go ahead. Sorry.
That people can use here. One takes about 15 minutes, and we call it the personal histories exercise, and it sounds ridiculous, but it really works. And that is, we just go around the table of a team and have people tell us where they grew up, how many kids were in their family, and where they were in that order, and what was the most difficult challenge of their childhood, not their inner childhood, but just being a kid. And it's crazy how this annoying boss or this annoying coworker, when they start to tell people how they grew up and what happened to them as a kid, suddenly things become explained, and it speaks to this fundamental attribution error that Mitchell talked about before. Suddenly you realize this guy grew up in a family of 9 kids, and they were poor and had one bathroom. No wonder he's so scrappy. Or this was an only child whose parents weren't very attentive to him, and no wonder he's like this. And suddenly you develop some compassion for that person. And so we're amazed at, when we do this silly little exercise, how people go from judgment to compassion, because they understand the why.
Well, you also bring in some of the personal, so it's not only just professional, or it's not only just occupational or vocational or whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to bring in some more callers. Linda, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from Richmond, and I'm really enjoying this program. I retired here from the East Coast University, and I was in an ethics institute, and I got a new director every several years. And one of my new directors, a woman that I had great respect for academically, a lovely person, but she'd never been a manager in her life. So we started off really badly because she went out of town for like a week, and she never notified anybody. She didn't tell me. She didn't tell anyone. And all of a sudden, millions of meetings were getting canceled, and people were, where is she? And I need an answer and whatever. And when she returned, I felt like and I'm not a very confrontational person, that I had to go in and say, look, this is not going to work. I feel really disrespected. I'm the one that had to grovel and apologize and do all of these things. And there was an easy fix for this. And I think because we were an ethics institute, as Cheryl just said, the shaming part, she was so horrified that she had respected me that little, and as well as all her colleagues. She just was not used to answering to anyone, really, in terms of what she did as an academic. She showed up for her classes, and that was that. So that just turned our complete relationship around. From then on, we worked together as a team. She was very considerate of anything that was going on, making sure I knew where she was, what her availability might be, and all of those things. I had had a lot more experience as an administrator than she had as a manager, and she was willing to tap into that, and we just conquered the world. Let's put it that way.
Good for you, Linda, because it sounds like you approach this like we've been talking about. You know, it's not about her. It's about how you're experiencing her. The fact is, there's no school, although I teach in a management department. How do you learn to be a manager? You learn by making mistakes. I don't know, Linda,
Absolutely.
How you learn. You know, you learn your craft by making mistakes, and hopefully you pick yourself up and you go on. And I think what you did sounds like a hugely important episode for this person's career development.
Nice success story, Linda. Thank you for...
Thank you very much for the program, as always.
Yeah, thank you for that, too. And let me get another caller on. Dan, you're next.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Morning.
I'm a member of a small low-tech company in San Jose. There's 4 partners. We've been in business a little less than 10 years. And one of the partners has always had a difficult personality, but it's gotten to the point where we're having employees threaten to leave because of him. We've had to insulate him from any of the employees. I mean, he just he's very insulting. He's derogatory. He's very disrespectful of people, and it's a problem because he is a partner.
You can't do a divorce like they did recently with that guy in the company, the American Apparel company. They had like 9 hours meeting, and he was one of the founders, and they said, take a walk, basically.
Does he still bring something to the table? Is he adding something, or is he just riding on the success of the company's past?
Well, he's got some good qualities.
But he's driving people crazy.
Driving people crazy.
Yes.
How aware is he of this?
I'm sorry?
How aware is he? Have people talked to him more than a few times?
We've talked to him 3 or 4 times, and I don't know if he. I think he's kind of tone deaf.
You try cattle prods? No, I'm just joking, obviously. But I mean, at what point do you just say, this can't go on? I mean, I think that's really implicit in the questioning that this caller is bringing to our attention here. Sharon Salzberg, let's get some wisdom from you here.
Well, I think there's also the question of, are they willing to learn? They may be tone-deaf or not picking up the cues, but there are actually certain skills of communication that, if you're willing, you can learn. And to tie the... I think it's very hard to see the consequences of our action, including our speech, and to tie that really directly is very helpful. You know, we have employees who are ready to go. We think you add these many valuable things, but this is an untenable situation. You know, we would like this to happen and not just leave it up to his growing awareness to know what to say or do, but to have him learn some options, learn some skills.
Well, good luck to you, Dan, and thank you for bringing this to our attention. Hope you can find some peace and comfort in that situation. Here's Michael in San Rafael, who writes, I'm a freelance designer. I once went to an interview at a large technology company, having been told I would meet with three people. Two of them showed up in the conference room and told me that the third person, their manager, would not be attending. After a bit of chit-chat, the meeting began. The very first thing I was asked, before anything about me and what I do or their business, was, how do you deal with difficult people? I told them I do everything I can in my business practice to make sure that people have no reason to be difficult. This didn't seem to reassure them. Fortunately for me, I didn't get the job. So let's talk about how you should answer that sort of a question. Anybody want to weigh in?
Well, there's a saying in my business, everything is data. The fact that this manager didn't show up, they probably were trying to keep that person away from you. So, like you say, it is good news Michael in San Rafael. So Michael, I think you were very fortunate as you didn't come through. Fact is, again, this gets back to the blind spot. The fact is that those two people who did meet with you didn't want to talk about this person being difficult with that person in the room. And they were just trying to see if you could survive rather than thrive in that organization. And I think you picked up on your own senses and probably did the right thing there.
Patrick Lencioni?
You know, years ago I worked for Oracle for 2 years. And Oracle, one of the things they did during interviews is they asked people if they could deal with difficult people. In fact, they wanted to know if you could deal with very aggressive, overbearing people. And if you didn't seem like the kind of person that could match cockiness for cockiness, and difficulty for difficulty, they didn't want you there. And in a bizarre way, it was healthy. They knew what they were getting into. But you don't want to work at every company in the world. And I think part of the problem we have is that when we interview, we think we're supposed to convince people that we should work there. And maybe very, very possibly you did the right thing by you went to the interview, you were yourself, and you found out, and they found out you weren't a fit.
Well, sometimes, you know, we're talking about difficult people or annoying people or dysfunctional people, people who don't add to the team. Sometimes they're emotionally damaged people. Sometimes, you know, let's face it, they have, you know, Asperger or some other syndrome that can be actually diagnosed. But here's a rather practical question, and anybody can of the three of you can take this up. What do you do with a coworker who is doing his personal hygiene in the office, sneezes without covering his mouth or nose, much emphasized after that sneeze study featured on NPR, compounded that this worker is always angry all the time? We're laughing, but these are day-to-day, quotidian kind of confrontations that people have to deal with. You know, see somebody sneezing my way and not covering their mouth, I get agitated.
Well, I will jump in and say this. If you're not telling them, you're not loving them. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. In all of these cases, I want to know, is somebody sitting down and kindly saying these are not acceptable behaviors? And then Sharon mentioned this earlier.
You're saying I'm a slob?
Yeah.
That's the response you'll get, Patrick.
If they say, I know, I struggle with this, I'm sorry, I'm working on it, they display some vulnerability, you're like, okay, let's help them. If they say, I don't think I do that, or I don't care, it shouldn't matter, then you take a different course. But the first thing is you've got to love them enough to tell them the truth.
It also depends on the context of your workplace. If you are a large organization with a sophisticated HR department, and you feel totally uncomfortable going directly to this person. First of all, let me back up as one step. I don't disagree with confronting them and walking up to them in a very, to use one of your other panelists' words, in a loving way.
Do you agree with Patrick that they should? I'm going to love some guy who sneezes on me?
You can love them, but still go to HR. and you can, because the point is, you have to think of the aftermath. If you go to this person and they think you're the crazy one, No one else. Look, we got 500 people at this workplace. No one else has told me I've sneezed on them. It must be your issue. So I'm just saying, remember, go back to the point that the messenger gets shot sometime. So if you can go through HR, do that. Otherwise, just sit the person down and be as direct as possible. It bothers me. You know, you're not a jerk for sneezing. People sneeze, but it bothers me. It's about me.
Yeah, it's also possible to say I get nervous when, you know, people sneeze right in my face because, you know, 15 people in my family have been sick. So I'm really asking you to please be considerate, which is really different than you're a menace to public health.
I'm going to read some more comments here before I go to more calls. Here's a listener who writes, what I have seen frequently in high tech is a cluster of mismanagement scenarios that are no better than what I saw as a teenager working in the fast food industry. One, do-nothing cronies help one another at the expense of the company and their coworkers and even try to get more honest or more talented coworkers removed. Two, a technical person who has no social skills and no self-awareness becomes a manager and treats underlings like they're a lower caste. Three, a person who is too young and lacks maturity is erroneously appointed to become a manager and gets a power trip from lording over older workers. Four, middle management spends its time living the easy life in day-long meetings about nothing while ardently demanding accountability from underlings in what seems to be a corporate echo of Southern plantation life.
Sounds like that person is a bad fit with that culture. You know, if the organization tolerates these day-long meetings doing nothing, then that's the culture of that organization, and maybe you're just a bad fit for it. You know, from that litany of issues there. Think about your own wellness and your own role in that organization. But also, you know, this is again a time where you've got to look for opportunities to think about yourself and what you have to do to express that self. And if it can be done in the workplace, I'm not saying you jump up and leave, and can you maybe get switched to a different department or something, but also look at your culpability in putting up with this.
Let me get to another key question before I go to our callers, back to our callers. Here's Laura who writes, during the job search process and before taking a job, is there a way to rule out dysfunctional work environments? Any tips on a kind of Geiger counter for discovering dysfunctional work environments, Patrick or Sharon?
Yeah, I think that when you interview, that's one of the things you need to be looking for. There's in my book, The Advantage, I talk about the four elements of a healthy organization, and you can't tell all of them in an interview. But one of them is: does the executive team get along? Do they have good conversations? Do they work well together? Is there clarity about what the organization stands for, or are they ambiguous? Do they communicate well? And do they reinforce it all? So if you're going to an interview and you don't have any sense of the company's values or strategy or what it's about, and they're not telling you anything about that company, and you should ask questions about how management gets along. If you see that there's dysfunction at the top, and if you see there's not clarity about what the organization's all about, that's a very good sign that it's dysfunctional. So your job in an interview is really to kindly probe for clarity and for healthiness in an organization.
And we'll go to more of our calls. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, what happens if you have a highly unethical boss and you simply can't afford to quit your job? What happens then?
Yeah, and in fact, I'm looking at an email here that dovetails with what you're asking, Neil. Another listener says, what do you do when you're in a much-coveted position, less than a decade to retirement, and you don't have the option of leaving? I mean, those kind of things have to factor in here. Anybody want to step up to the plate here and talk about
it? Sometimes you just
Mitchell
have
Marks?
To deal with it. You have to just deal with the classic stress management activity. Get exercise, get rest, find the meaning that you do find in work. Look at the upside of work. The fact is, if you're a few years from retirement, you're not going to rock the boat, and nor should anyone suggest that you do. And you may just have to suck it in and deal with it. Now, if we're talking about highly illegal or unethical, that's different. If you work at a larger organization and they have an ethics officer or a compliance officer, I think the world is changing a little bit. But just to get back to a moment about this person who was looking for a new position, keep in mind that in some organizations, the culture is aggressive. Don't confuse aggressiveness with dysfunctionality. If any of your listeners saw the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, and you saw all the money being made by stockbrokers being completely aggressive, completely insensitive to coworker relations,
and completely unethical.
And I was thinking about adding that also, but the fact is, you as an individual may choose to join that organization to get compensation. That's a choice you can make in your life. You know, if that's what you want, if you're comfortable. I'm not passing judgment. I mean, I think being unethical is wrong, but that's not my job to tell you that you shouldn't work in an organization like that.
But there are a lot of people who have problems in the workplace because they feel things are unethical, because they feel that the organization doesn't have the integrity that they are high-minded enough to think ought to be the bar, or because it's not moral, frankly.
And that's, again, where you have to see, is it me or is it the organization? If that's the organization and that's their culture, you're not going to change the entire culture of the organization. If it's just me and my situation, then maybe I talk to the individual about that.
And Sharon Salzberg, here's a tweet from a listener. It says, how common are mean girls dynamics among groups of women in the workplace? My last job felt like high school all over again.
Oh, it can be, can it? I mean, I think part of a culture of an organization is how people speak to one another, and certainly there can be a tremendous, apart from gender, you know, there can be a tremendous emphasis on this feeling that if I can only demean others enough and put them down enough, I'll feel better about myself. So the first thing is to protect yourself and not to take it in. You know, if somebody's just criticizing you, find out if there's some data that supports that, or is this just their mean attitude coming through? And to not participate, you know, not join into it, because you will feel in the end that that's kind of an ethical violation, too, that you've become someone that you really don't want to be.
We could do a whole program just on, you know, old boys clubs and the feeling that women get being excluded. Mm-hmm. But also it's interesting that this woman listener tweets about mean girls. And I've even got an email in front of me talking about suggestions for dealing with people of different races. I mean, that, too, mm-hmm. could be a whole program unto itself. Let me go to another caller here, and we'll go to Philip in San Francisco. Good morning.
I'm wondering if your panel there has read Adam Grant, who's a professor at Wharton School of Business. He was interviewed by Charlie Rose. That's where I learned about him. He's written a book called Give and Take. He says that there's three types of people in the world, and not only in the business world. There are the givers, the takers, and the matchers. He points out there's two kinds of givers, the selfless givers who end up being doormats, and the otherish givers who learn how to give reasonably and even inspire giving from other people. And in the book, there's a number of methods for eliciting giving from other people.
Well, it's interesting that you could divide the world into three types like that. But, I mean, you know, when you talk about the workplace, you're talking about people who can be just like the whole variety and range of people that we deal with in every walk of life. Terribly self-centered, wonderfully selfless, I mean, just a whole continuum. But thanks for letting us know about that, Philip. Appreciate hearing from you. Brian writes, there are certain personality types that describe the problematic person you are speaking of. I don't know which he's alluding to here, but he says, these people are often very talented. My ex-wife is a covert narcissist, extremely talented, insufferable. With no personality stuff allowed in resumes or a reason for firing, she would get top jobs over and over, and then they would have to figure a creative way to get rid of her. So you do find these people, Mitchell, getting up in management positions over and over again, like you said before.
And there's a lot of denial. There's a lot of blind spots. You would think in this situation that the listener is describing that she would get it sooner or later, but obviously she didn't get it. He got it because he was living with her for a time period. But the and again, that's the uphill battle that people who have to contend with is you're confronting someone who has minimal, if any, self-awareness about how they're contributing to the situation. They just don't get it. They rationalize it because they've been producing money or they've been getting the products out to the marketplace and things like that. So that's the real struggle there, I think.
And if I go back to you for a moment, Patrick Lencioni, here's a listener who says, I think the guest shortchanged Phil by telling him that when he hit a brick wall, it was time to leave the organization. Surely there were more alternatives that could have been offered.
Well, I think the thing is Phil went to the mat a number of times, and sometimes you just realize it is what it is. He doesn't have to leave. He can accept it for what it is and make the most of it. But I think that when you've gone there, and he sounds like he had a lot of courage, you have a choice to make at some point.
Yeah, that's really good advice, because you have to step back and think, look, I'm getting a paycheck from these people.
Right.
They are supporting my lifestyle. Can I deal with this a few more years? So I didn't mean to cut you off, but
no.
just You got to look at the fuller. It's not just about my interaction with person X or person Y. It's the fuller picture of what I'm getting from this organization.
Right. Your worldview matters, too. I mean, we suffer in life, and sometimes we can offer that suffering up, and it makes us better people. And I think sometimes in jobs we have a difficult situation. We're dealing with difficult people, and we're treated poorly, and we have to say, well, through this I might grow in holiness, and I'll learn to love these people who are very hard to love.
Yeah, now I know why you talk to the churches.
Yeah.
But here's an online question. And Mitchell Marks, you've been mentioning HR, and Alan writes, and I'm glad he raises this question, what about when HR is the problem?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's often the case because the reality is in some organizations, HR is world-class and sophisticated. In some organizations, there is gossipy, there is political.
And ineffectual.
Yeah. And so then you got to, again, look at yourself. Do I want to stay in a place like this? If you can move on, maybe it's an opportunity. You know, if an organization – to me, the status and the prominence of HR tells you a lot about the values of the organization. And if it's an afterthought, if they're part of the problem, why are you working in an organization like that? Well, you may be working there because you have no other alternatives. That's fine. But this might be an opportunity for you to talk to other workers, talk to coworkers. The problem here is that most people turn inward and shut it down. They think I'm the problem. And so if you can talk to other employees about HR, if nothing else, just the venting, just talking about it, is healthy. It's more than nothing. It's not going to change the world. That's where it comes to changing your view of the world. If you have to say, okay, HR is just a bunch of wimps here. I'm just going to have to accept that, and I'm just not going to be able to use them as an asset. Do good work. Make a connection with your boss. Try to get to the point with your boss where you can start perhaps sharing some of the things that you might take to HR in another organization. But try and build on positivity and getting the job done.
All good advice. And Sharon Salzberg, you would add perhaps meditate. Hmm?
Well, it helps, actually, because I think that's one of the ways that you return to a different sense of yourself. And you do come back to your priorities and with greater clarity and greater compassion.
On that note, I want to thank all of you. Sharon Salzberg is the author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. We thank you for being with us on this forum hour. Thanks to Patrick Lencioni, founder of The Table Group and author of The Advantage and the Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and Mitchell Marks, who is here with us in studio, professor in the College of Business at SF State and author of Charging Back Up the Hill, Workplace Recovery After Mergers, Acquisitions, and Downsizing. And thanks to you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour of forum repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and you can always let us know what you think about what you hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, and you can continue this discussion online at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. Forum's producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.